Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program this evening is called Achieving Success with the Help of a Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priorities. Our panelists tonight are Mary Stutz, author of The Missing Mentor, Senior Vice President, Elan Corporation, Evelyn Dilsaber, former President and CEO, Charles Schwab Investment Management, and Mary Cranston, Senior Partner, Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, LLP, immediate past chair and CEO of the firm. So tonight we'll be opening with about a 20-minute presentation by Mary Stutz based on her new book, which really, The Missing Mentors, is the heart of this program. Evelyn and Mary Cranston were interviewed for this book. That's how this program really came about. So we'll have an introduction by Mary Stutz and then discussion with all three of our panelists. Then we'll open it up for questions and answers from the floor. I'm going to give you the bio, first of all, for all three of the ladies tonight, and then we'll have Mary. So Mary Stutz is the author of The Missing Mentor, Senior Vice President, Elan Corporation. A seasoned executive, Mary Stutz has worked more than 25 years in the healthcare and communications industry and is currently the Senior Vice President of Corporate Relations at Elan Pharmaceuticals. Prior to joining Elan, Stutz also served as Vice President of Corporate Communications for United Health Group, Head of Corporate Relations for Genentech, and directed public policy and communications for Bayer Corporation's Global Biotechnology Unit. She's also an author, speaker, and lecturer, and The Missing Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priorities, is her second book. Mary Cranston, senior partner, Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, LLP, immediate past chair and CEO of the firm. She's the firm's senior partner and immediate past chair. Some accolades include international expansion through two of the largest law firm mergers in history and achieving top 10 rankings among U.S. law firms for women. Cranston has been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal and one of two best law firm leaders in the United States by Of Counsel. She currently sits on several public company boards, including Visa and Juniper Networks. Evelyn Dilsaber, former president and CEO of Charles Schwab Investment Management, is a recognized leader in building highly motivated teams in both the public and nonprofit sectors. As president and CEO of Charles Schwab Investment Management, she grew assets from $137 billion to over $200 billion in 4 years. She was also chair of the board for Women's Initiative, a nonprofit organization that helps lower-income women become economically independent. Dilsaber also served as controller for First National Bank and for the Charles Schwab Corporation, as well as CFO and Chief Administrative Officer for U.S. Trust, a subsidiary of Schwab. She currently sits on several boards, including Aeropostale and Tempur-Pedic. And now I'd like to introduce Mary Stutz.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank you, Mary and Evelyn, for joining me, and thank you to all of you for being here tonight. I am very excited to talk to you about the book, The Missing Mentor, and to have what I'm hoping will be a very stimulating dialogue tonight about mentoring for women. Just to give you a little bit of background as far as why I wrote the book, I do, as Kevin mentioned, a lot of public speaking, and as a matter of fact, that's how I met Evelyn. Mary was on a panel that we did some years ago, but as I would go out and speak, I would always inevitably get so many women coming up to me afterwards, no matter what the topic was about, no matter what the conference was about, asking me if I would mentor them. And I initially tried to mentor all of these folks. And of course, you know, you do the math, that just was not working. After a while, I realized there's no way that I can mentor them all, but I wanted to get them the information that they were seeking because I could see myself through all the steps of my career in the women who were coming up to me and in the questions that they were asking. So that's why I wrote the book, and one of the folks that I worked with called it The Missing Mentor, and it's been kind of dubbed as a surrogate mentor. But the whole idea is that that women, senior women in leadership positions are not able to provide the level of mentoring to meet the needs of women in the workforce. And if you just do the math, what is it? I think 58% of college graduates in the U.S. are women. It's a little bit higher than that in Europe. So you look at these women coming into the marketplace, plus women already in the marketplace looking to move up, compared to the numbers of executive women in leadership, and you do the math, there the chances of women being able to get mentored by other women were very slim. And it's interesting because when women would ask me about mentoring, I would say, well, don't you have your boss or your supervisor or someone who can mentor you? And they would say, oh, yeah, and they help me, but it's a man. So we're not here to male bash. But the point that they made was that there were things that they had questions about that the men weren't able to provide the input and give the information. Now, let me just say, there are far more male mentors than women, and that's a great thing, and we want that to continue. But again, the challenge for a lot of women in the workplace is that they want to talk to other women who have made the decisions about family, about relationships, about mobility, and those kinds of things, about education. And so they wanted to talk to other women who had juggled it all. Now, just to give you a sense of just a little bit of background and data as far as why senior women in leadership are not mentoring. And it's interesting because whenever everyone that I talk to in senior leadership about this did not dispute it. In fact, they agreed. And I think a lot of the women, I'm not speaking for the two here, but I think a lot of them almost participated in the book out of a sense of guilt because they knew that they were not able to mentor as much. But let me just give you some data on why that might be. 90% of male C-suite executives, chief executive officer, chief financial officer, all the C-suite folks, have stay-at-home spouses. And if you look at women, it's 70 to 80% of the female executives in the C-suite have spouses who work. So what's happening is that no matter how high up a woman goes in her career, she still has the primary accountability for home and family. And no one has disputed that. They totally agree. And so what happens is that time, that extra time where they might do more mentoring, they end up using that time for their family. And if they do mentor, it was a challenge that I had as well, your first priority is to mentor the folks who are in your group, the members of your team and your company. So just to give you, that was just to give you a little background on why the book evolved and what the challenges are. Now, why mentoring is important. A 2005 study that was published in the Journal of Healthcare Management did a study on what are the skills and the managerial experiences necessary for women, for people, managers, leaders, to develop strategic thinking capability. And one of the things the study found out that was a side finding, this was not what they were looking for, but one of the things they found out is that the study suggests an imbalance exists between male and female work experiences that develop strategic thinking ability. Now, that's important because if you want to move up the ladder, you have to have work experiences that are going to help you develop your strategic thinking capabilities. Mentoring is the number one experience conducive to general managerial learning, number one on the list of skills that, and experiences that you need to have. So what's happening is that women are not being given access to skills such as job rotations, scope expansions, leads in a startup or a turnaround, running a P&L, a profit and loss center, getting a challenging assignment, or turning a company around or dealing with a major crisis for the company. So women are not, this study found that women are not getting access to these experiences, and they called it out. And in fact, there was a side editorial about this and how that's going to be a significant challenge. Now, this was in, they were looking specifically at healthcare, but that how that's going to be a significant challenge going forward if women are not getting these experiences because they are needed to move up the ladder and to get into these senior level positions. So that was something that was interesting data. And you know the main reason why women are not getting access to these skills? They don't ask. They're not asking. So in my research for the book, another thing that came up, as you may have heard mentioned, I interviewed actually 11 women are featured in the book. So as I worked on it, I thought, well, I'll tell how I advanced my career with and without a mentor, but I'm going to also go and talk to women in different fields, different career paths, and let them tell how they advance their careers with or without a mentor. And so that's why you have folks like Evelyn and Mary in the book. But one of the folks that I talked to was, from Corn Ferry. and I can't believe I just blanked on her name. But from Eunice Azani. Thank you. Yeah, see? Everybody knows who she is. Eunice Azani is like the uber executive recruiter at Corn Ferry. And she's like the person to have your name in her Rolodex. She actually just retired and started her own search, Azani Search. But she talked about how she has worked with men and women over the years, placing them in very powerful positions. And one of the things that she saw over and over again is that women do not negotiate. They tend to take what is offered. As a matter of fact, women tend to come into the workplace and think, if I just keep my head down and do a good job, all these great things are going to happen. Somebody will notice and I'll advance. And that's not, we cannot take that que sera, sera, very passive attitude to our career if we're very serious about moving forward. And so those are the types of things that I talk about in the book. And one of the things, so a lot of companies are having me come and speak to them and speak to their women. I was just at Medtronic 2 weeks ago. There were over 350 women. This is a very much a crucial issue right now. And one of the things I always ask is, how many of you have a development plan? Just a show of hands. How many women? Yeah. And this is even less than normal. And it never fails, wherever I go, whatever companies I go to, and I ask this question, 25% or less of the women in the room raise their hands to say that they have a development plan. Now, it's interesting because even if you don't have a manager who is requiring you to have a development plan, at Genentech it was required for everybody to have a development plan. In my department, everybody, administrative assistants all the way up, had development plans. But it's interesting, even if your company does not require you to have one or your boss has not sat down with you to develop one, 9 times out of 10, your human resources department has a template for a development plan online in their online HR program. And you should look for that and be aggressive and complete it yourself, work on it, go to your manager, sit down with him or her and say, look, I want to do a development plan to lay out where I want to be in 3, 5, 10 years in my career. Because I think you've all heard the saying, if you don't know where you're going, any road will take you there, right? So the biggest problem for a lot of women with advancing their careers, they do not have a plan. And as a matter of fact, when I would agree to ask to mentor women, and I would say, okay, I'm going to mentor you, I set a time for them to come into my office and talk to me, and it never failed that they would show up in my office and they're like, okay, I'm here, mentor me. They had no plan, no questions for me, no project that they wanted to ask about, nothing about their career. It was amazing to me, the lack of thought, forethought and planning around your career. And so that was one thing. The other thing, as far as women not being prepared to be mentored, one, there was no plan. Two, there was no sense of timing and respect for the mentor's time. So what I talk about in the book, that if you are fortunate enough to get someone who's willing to mentor you, you should be prepared to get in and out in 15 minutes. 15 minutes. Because then maybe you'll get another 15 minutes. And so if you come in and you have no plan and you don't respect their time, then you're not going to get the access. And you can get mentored very well via email, by the way. But again, I should not have to schedule calendar time to read your email. Three or four paragraphs three or four sentences per paragraph. It's amazing how many just really practical tips that people are looking for. And by the way, the mentors are very eager to hear this information too, because women who do decide, yes, I want to mentor, it's amazing. I've gotten so many of them coming to me saying, when are you going to write a book for us? Tell us how to be a mentor. But I think actually it all is in there. It could work both ways. But the reason that it's so important for you to have a plan, to be confident in your plan. There are seven steps, seven concepts that I talk about in the book, and I'll just run through those very quickly. One is about being confident, building your confidence, prioritizing your work-life choices. There's no such thing as work-life balance. It's work-life choices. You get to choose. Your company is not responsible for balancing your work and your life. Your boss is not responsible. It's the choices that you make, and only you and your family get to make those choices. It's building and nurturing relationships, sustaining your spiritual well-being, positioning for change, lifelong learning, orchestrating transitions, and the final chapter is career derailers, how not to derail your career, which is very important because I've seen very promising, talented folks who derail themselves because they have a fatal flaw. So we go through some of those derailers in the book as well, which we won't have time to go into tonight, but I just want to give you a sense of what's in the book. But a couple of points that I want to make before I start the dialogue with my other two panelists. The significance of confidence. Again, I can't begin to tell you how important this is. And the main reason why this is so important is because I want you to understand that people who are in the C-suite, people who are running companies, you heard the resumes, the bios of the guests here. They are responsible for multi-billion dollar companies, thousands of employees, and that whose livelihood and whose jobs depend on them making the right decision and running that company appropriately. And let me tell you something that I have found. And again, I won't speak for the two folks here, but for the most part, folks in those positions are terrified. If you ask them what keeps you up at night about this, about your job, about the company, 9 times out of 10, they have a list of stuff that keeps them up at night. They are terrified of screwing up, of the, you know, messing up the company, ruining the finances of the company. So they are looking for confident, capable, skilled people who can help them. Sorry to tell you, they're not really looking to help you. They're looking for people who can help them. That should be your attitude when you show up at the company. How can I help you run this company and keep it successful and keep it growing and thriving? We have to change the whole dynamic of how we talk and how we present ourselves. And it's amazing. When I did the, one of the things we did was to have a luncheon for the editors of the women's magazines when the book launched. And they had said to me, oh, you usually get 10 or 12 editors. We actually had 22 editors from all of the various women's magazines at this luncheon in New York. But some of the editors from a couple of the magazines that skewed to a younger female population said to me when I was talking to them, well, I've heard that if you just do a good job, your mentor will find you. Yeah. So do you see that passive, you know, attitude and good things are just going to come my way if I'm just nice to everybody and do a good job? It's not the truth, and we need to understand why when you walk into a room, you need to exude that confidence. You have to know what you want or at least have some idea of where you want to go and be able to ask the right questions to get there. Now, let me just tell you a quick story that happened to me with this whole area of confidence. When I also worked at Kaiser for 8 years before Bayer, and when I was at Kaiser, I was selected to participate in this leadership program at Stanford. And I went to the program, and it was like a 3-day program, and the professor, and there were executives from all different companies here in the Bay Area. They actually came from all over the world, literally, to be in that program. And one of the exercises that they had us do was he asked for people to come up and tell why you know, they were in the program and why they felt they needed to be in a leadership program. And so, you know, I think the two people raised their hand. This one guy was the chief of police in a metropolitan area. And then there was a woman who had started a small airline. And then so I'm sitting there and I thought, oh, that looks pretty easy. So, you know, my hand goes up, and I go up there, and I start talking about, well, I'm taking this program because I think I'm not being challenged enough in my job, and I want to get on a new career track, and I think this program will help me. And, you know, so I don't remember what all I said. But anyway, now all these other people, when they were up there, when they finished, he said, good job, very convincing, so forth. I finish, and he says, so, Mary, did you give a lot of little talks when you were a kid? Did you say a lot of little poems and things like that? And it's like, yeah. And he says, and did you do little pirouettes and flips and turns? And I'm like, okay, this is not going the way I expected it to go. This is not a good thing. And he starts just kind of going through all this stuff with me, and I'm thinking, where is a good earthquake when you need one? I'm just ready to sink into the floor. But when I finished, he said that, I mean, when he finished, his point was that so many times with women, we are people pleasers. And even the way we talk, we're trying to please everybody, and we want everybody to like us, as opposed to coming in and presenting our information very much in an attitude of, I know what I'm talking about. These are the facts. You can take it or leave it. And a lot of times we do not exude that, so we're not even exuding the confidence that we need when we're talking. And so he made me do it again in front of everybody. But by then, I actually do better and articulate much better when I'm angry. So so when I did it over and was just very matter of fact, and you know, and the thing is, I knew how to do that. But for whatever reason, we revert back, and again, we get into this mode of wanting to please people and worrying about what everybody thinks. And when I did it over, everyone could tell the market difference. I had my information. I had my facts. I had a plan, and I had a plan for working my plan, and I was able to articulate that, and it was much more impactful. But it was very much a learning for me to understand the importance of your presence and how you show up in a room. We had an executive at one company where I worked who was a woman, a C-suite woman, and because I worked in the corporate relations group, we had to do a lot of work to prepare our senior executives to go out and talk about the company. And the feedback we got from the analysts about this one executive was that she's a talking head. What does that mean? Well, she talks like this. And these are the numbers. And this is why we think we're going to hit it. And there was no credibility. They did not trust her information, although her information was very true and very factual. And she was an excellent executive, and she knew how to do her job. And they were exceeding the numbers. But that credibility was challenged immediately just by the presence. How you show up in a room, it does make a difference. And like I said, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. So there are steps to confidence that are talked about in that first chapter. Work-life choices, I talked about that. The other example I wanted to give, I talk about building and nurturing relationships. And the point that I wanted to make there is you hear a lot about networking. You hear people talk about networking. I personally don't really care for that term because it sounds like something you want to do to, you know, use people to try to help you get a job. And I just don't like to use the term. So I always like to say to everybody, be nice to everybody, right? And the example I give is when I was in graduate school at the University of Southern California, my first day, now my mentors, mind you, my mentor was the CEO of the company as well as the SVP who was my boss, but they were my mentors and they had said to me, because my initial background was in communications, and they said, if you really want to move forward in healthcare, then you need to go back to school and get an advanced degree in health administration. Now, if you're going to have mentors, you need to do what they say, even though you are peeved and you really don't want to do that, and that was not what you had in mind, but anyway. So I, you know, they wrote the letters for me. I applied to all these schools and got in and chose USC. And my first day, I show up at the program in Sacramento, their health administration program. I'm late because I've underestimated the time to drive there. I rush in. They're already doing the introductions. And just as I come in and sit down, then the professor says to me, okay, do your introduction. And so I start, and I say who I am and where I work and that I'm from the Bay Area. And as soon as I'm done, immediately the professor says, oh, that's great. You're from the Bay Area. Well, Lisa over here is from the Bay Area, and she needs somebody to carpool to school with. And I'm peeved. I am beyond ticked. Because first of all, you don't even know me. How are you volunteering me to carpool with somebody? And I don't know Lisa. She could be a serial killer. That's literally what I was thinking. I was so angry and aggravated. And so when the break happened, I was firmly planted in my seat. I was not getting up to talk to Lisa or anybody else. And so she came over to me. And she said, hi, you know, I just wanted to say I'm a student. I'm from Southern California. I only work part-time. And it's been a challenge for me financially to have to, you know, buy gas and drive here the 4 days a week for school, and I would really appreciate it if I could carpool with you. So, of course, I'm not going to turn that down, right? It's like, okay, we'll try it and see. So over the course of the, you know, the next 2 years in graduate school, we get to be really good friends, and we learned about each other. I actually, during that time, helped her to get hired on at Kaiser. But 2 years later, it was Lisa who got the call from the executive search firm, a friend of hers who had gotten the call from the executive search firm, looking for a global director of public policy and communications for Bayer, just the kind of job that I wanted. They were doing a global search. And she got the call, and she says, well, you know, that's not my skill set, but I know the perfect person with that skill set. And she gave them my name. And I ended up, out of all those people globally, getting hired for that job. So the moral of that story is, be nice to everybody. Just be nice. Don't even think about networking. So those are the points that I wanted to make as I'm getting the clock here. Okay, so now I'm going to turn it over to Evelyn. And Evelyn and I met on a panel, and she was so gracious to agree to participate in the book and to be interviewed. And Evelyn is featured in the chapter on orchestrating transitions. And just her story, these are called power-up profiles, and I feature a different woman in every chapter. But I wanted you to just talk a little bit about how you've advanced your career with or without a mentor. You gave me some really great advice in the book about how you manage things like getting a promotion where they didn't want to give you the title and things like that. So
right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Mary, for having us here. And actually, I don't call it networking.
Yeah.
I call it make your friends before you need them.
Good.
Which is another way of doing same thing. So when I got my background as a CPA and a controller, and after 17 years of being in the finance side of the business, I decided I really wanted to run a part of the business. I really wanted to run a big division inside Schwab. And it felt like as controller that all I was doing was recording everybody else's decisions. And for those of you in the finance, it felt like your monthly period. Every month you had to close those books and just always came, right? You never could take that vacation. So I really wanted to be in the part of making decisions. And I had several people in the company that I could look to who trusted me because I had worked with them before. And I told them, this is what I want to do. And so one guy, a lot of them were guys, who said to me, okay, I have this opportunity. It's a strategic job. And call me in 6 months, it's probably open. And 6 months later, I called him, the job was open, I took it. And I started to move around the company, picking up sales, business development, operations, product development, strategy, M&A. But you know, while I enjoyed it, the hard part about that is you get compared to everybody else who's been doing the job for a long time. So in many cases, I had to kick myself because I'd see people advancing in front of me. And I thought, shoot, if I'd stayed in that job a little bit longer, maybe I would have gotten the advancement. But I had to keep reminding myself, just like you said with your own plan, this is what you chose. You chose to do this because you wanted to pick up the new skills. And you're bringing all the other skills you've learned with you, but you're picking up new skills. So sure, you're going to miss out on a bonus, or sure, you're going to miss out on stock options because it gets granted based on how high you rank in the skill set. But at the end of the day, I finished as president of the mutual fund company, which, as Kevin said, it was $200 billion in size and $1 billion in revenue. When I got promoted into that job, it was a promotion. It was, hey, Ev, guess what? You get to be president of the company, but we're not giving you the executive vice president title, which is what the guy before me held. You're going to be a senior vice president. I said, well, that's not fair. I don't think I should have to do that. So I called the president of the company, who was a mentor of mine, and he called me up and said, hey, congratulations, Ev. You got this new role. I said, yeah, but it doesn't come with the EVP title, and I want the EVP title. He goes, well, you should have it. So he made it happen through HR. So that's what Mary's talking about in terms of speaking up. Knowing the predecessor in the role had the executive vice president title, they were going to give me the job and more because I was bringing sales and product development with me, but I wasn't going to get the title. Didn't sound right to me. So that's when you have to ask. You really do have to ask. The second big transition I made was when I decided to retire from Schwab. And I wanted to serve on corporate boards. Mary and I had served in a panel together, and I had always admired Mary, so we decided we were going to stay in touch after the panel discussion, just like we did. And I called Mary to talk about serving on boards. So now I serve on 4 corporate boards and 4 non-for-profit boards. And I really enjoy the strategic work that that brings. But I wouldn't have been able to do that had I not done what I did at Schwab, which was move around the company, gain the skills, end up in a role as president of the mutual fund business, because that allowed me to launch into the board career. And that was my transition, my next adventure, as you will. And I love it. I'm having a lot of fun with it, and it borrows on all the skills I learned, beyond the finance skills, but also all the operating skills that I learned while I was doing that. I had mentors along the way. Some were men. Very few women mentors, as you said. Very few. I tried to mentor many along the way. And the non-for-profit work that I'm a part of that Kevin mentioned, Women's Initiative for Self-Employment, we help low-income women start their own businesses. And there's a lot of mentoring in that as women start to become entrepreneurs, gain economic freedom, and serve their community. So there's a lot to the story, and that's my story.
Good. Thank you. Mary Cranston. So there's Mary and Mary and Evelyn. So Mary Cranston, thank you so much. And Mary is featured in the chapter on sustaining your spiritual well-being. And it's interesting because, you know, your story about definitely not having female mentors in the legal world, but also being in a role where women were placed, which was doing the research for the briefs, and your desire to move from that and not having a mentor, how you created an imaginary one and set about becoming her. I just found that really fascinating. And I think that's very helpful for women who, if you may not have a mentor, male or female, but that doesn't mean that you can't advance your career. So, Mary Cranston.
Yeah, that is something that I talk a lot about this to women's groups because I think there are still too few women, and depending on what your career aspirations are, you may be plowing some ground that no woman has been before. And so it's really critical, I think, and it certainly was for me, to realize that I could just get a picture of where I wanted to go and kind of hold that. And one of the things that, so early on I decided I wanted to be a top litigator. This was when I was a young lawyer. And because I realized, you know, being a top litigator meant you had client control and a lot of power in the firm. I really didn't know how I was going to get there. So I set a goal for myself that would have put me, I had financial and the number of client goals. And I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I said it very clearly. I thought about it every day, and I did the discipline every day of taking baby steps that I knew would move me in that direction. But the most interesting part of that whole process, it did take me 5 years, but I did get there. The most interesting part of the process, I think, was all the fears that came up in my own head about whether this was possible, whether I could do it. Should I just stop now? And I realized as time went on that these mental ideas about what is possible are actually probably the thing that holds women back the most. There's no question there is gender stereotyping in the environment, so it's tougher for women to prove that they're good at take charge skills, that they have the problem solving skills. But what really stops you is the part where we've bought it ourselves in our own heads. So I used this goal setting, and I would, if the fears would come up, I'd just kind of pat them on the head and go for it anyway. And there's, you know, I sort of developed that on my own in the 70s because there wasn't much out there. But there's a lot of research now that shows that women can do a lot for themselves by learning certain kinds of reframing of their of how they think about things so that they become more optimistic in the business environment. And, you know, mentors can certainly help you with this, but a lot of it is stuff that I think you have to do yourself. And it made a big difference in my life. One thing I was going to say about mentoring, and I'm so glad you wrote this book because I think it's a critical title. There's no question, a lot of research on the fact that people who have the best mentoring networks make more money, have more promotions, and are generally more successful. It's all correlated with some other factors, I think, but it is an important piece of the puzzle. And I think some of us think about a mentor as a particular person who's going to take us under the wing. But as Mary was saying, the plan is really the start, or in my case, the vision of what I wanted to do. Once you have a really authentic inner drive to do something, you can begin to figure out who can help you. And this is where there's a real difference between men and women in general. And there's a great new book out called How Remarkable Women Lead that looked at a lot of these statistics. But in general, women have fewer friends and deeper friendships. And there's a little cultural bias on the part of women not to trade on their friendships. That has to go. Really has to go. Yeah. Men, on the other hand, tend to have broader, and I hate to say this, guys, but shallower networks. And what these pioneer women who did really well and broke through the glass ceiling early figured out was that skill set of how to set up broader networks. And it really is, as Mary was saying, the skill of figuring out a reciprocal relationship with somebody that can help you. So you have your vision, your goal. You can do some actual mapping of who you know that could help you, and then who you know who knows somebody who could help you, so that you can begin this whole process of getting to know people who are going to be able to move your goal forward. And as you said, Mary, you don't just go in there and say, fix me.
Yeah.
You go in there because you know what the person you want to have help you is doing, what you could do for them, and then the ask of what they could do for you. So it's a narrower reciprocal relationship all tied to your business goals. And that's something, when I talk about these baby steps that I would take every day to move towards my vision, a lot of them were those kinds of reaching out to people that I didn't otherwise know. And it is amazing how much people want to help you, especially if it's a bit reciprocal. So I think, I guess I'll just stop there, but I think that part of the cultural impediments that women have is this, we are a little less likely to take risk, to ask, but what a lot of the research shows is that if you day in and day out don't take the risk to take a step that is for something you really want, that's a terrible message to your psyche. It's quite depressing. And in fact, the worst thing that happens when you take the risk is the person says no, or they say, I can't talk to you, gives you the name of somebody else. There's always another door opening, even if the door that you're originally trying to go through closes. So, you know, you can call it finding a mentor, but it ties in with a lot of other things. You have to be clear on what you want. You have to be able to articulate it well with confidence. Mm-hmm. And if you do this every day, you know, it's amazing how far you get in a year, in 2 years, in 3 years. So I guess I'll stop there.
So a couple of things that I wanted to follow up on. Some of the advice in the book is, first of all, that you should not have in your mind that there's only one perfect mentor for you. Mm-hmm. You, in reality, you should plan to build a network of mentors. And Mary said it, Evelyn alluded to it, and most of the women I interviewed for the book said the same thing. They don't have one perfect mentor for everything. They might have a mentor. Some of the folks talked about they have mentors who might be their board of directors for their organization, but those aren't the same mentors that they would use for career advancement or relationships or even your spiritual development. So you should plan on having even a network of mentors, and it doesn't always have to be that you are spending tons of time with these folks, but you build relationships and you can reach out to them at different times throughout the span of your career. Sometimes you might outgrow your mentor, and you need to get a different one. So you need to be open to what mentoring looks like, and it's not the traditional term that you know that people think of, that you just get one and you're set because you got one mentor. That's not the way it's going to evolve for you to be very successful. Now, we're going to open it up for Q&A. There was one thing, if you guys want to go ahead to the microphone to queue up for the Q&A, there was one thing that we talked about a little bit before we started, and that was information that came out from Harvard Business School. I'm going to be speaking at a conference there in February, and when they talked to me about it, they said that they had just gotten some information that the women in their MBA program were not performing as well as the men in the program. And they were very concerned about that. So even things like class participation and how they were performing on their projects and their case studies, you know, how they were being written up and prepared. So that was very interesting. So I wanted Mary and Evelyn to just share some thinking about what might be the cause about that, or what might need to be done about it, or just your thoughts in general.
You know, I sit on the Stanford Board of Trustees. I was actually stunned to hear that, because in general,
that's
the opposite is the case. So I don't know if it's an anomaly or what was going on there. I'd like to know more about it.
Yeah.
But I think in the as you know, the basic stereotype out there is that Catalyst has been researching this for a number of years, but that men take charge and women take care, and that women are less good at problem solving. This is not true, but it's a stereotype that is carried by both men and women. So if women don't have a plan or a communication vehicle to explain what they're doing or trying to do, then you have the chance of being perceived through that default lens that you're going to be less strategically talented. And it's really why the networking skills, the learning how to ask for mentors, all of these things tie together, and they allow you to hone and to articulate really clearly what you're going to do. The good news is information always trumps a stereotype. So if you learn how to express clearly your problem-solving skills, your take-charge skills, and you're very good at explaining how you want to do this and asking for help, gender stereotyping will actually kind of melt around you and really won't apply to you. If you're, on the other hand, passive and quiet, then it will be a problem. And one of the things, the research shows that women are much less likely to speak up in class, and this may be part of what's going on with this year's group at Harvard, but, and it's not even paranoid. If in a gender stereotyped world, you're going to be judged more harshly for problem-solving skills, the penalty you pay for making a mistake strategically is a lot higher. The problem is that is not the answer in terms of what you need to do. You need to actually take more risk. You need to speak up more, because that's fundamentally what's going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. To be too nervous about making a mistake is simply buying into the stereotype before you even start and not doing the things that will most effectively fix it. You know, hopefully in 20 years, it will be a much more level field and this won't matter, but it certainly still does today.
Yeah, and I also think that as women, we have a hard time being heard, as Mary said. Have you ever been in a meeting where you've come up with an idea, and then all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, somebody else came up with exactly the same idea, another male, maybe?
Yeah.
You're thinking, what did I just speak?
Didn't
Swahili?
Just
did they not hear my idea? So I've learned to say, gee, Tom, thanks for expanding on my idea. Now, let me go about it this way. And it really does kind of bring it right back to the fact that you were the one that came up with the idea without feeling like defensive, you know, because otherwise you can get, well, that was my idea, which I used to do, but then it sounded very defensive.
Right.
So now you just say, oh, gee, Tom, thanks for expanding on my idea. Now let's try to think about it this way. And it really kind of brings it back home.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Very good.
Okay, well, thank you. I think my mic is off here. Can you hear me? Okay. Back on now. Okay, well, thank you, ladies. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program this evening, Achieving Success with the Help of a Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priorities. Our speakers tonight are Mary Stutz, Evelyn Dilsaver, and Mary Cranston. We're going to open it up now for audience questions. If you'd like to go up to the microphone, please, and we'll take turns going.
No,
we'd like to record for the radio at home, please.
Yes, I'm wondering if you could talk about how important is it to have a sponsor in addition to a mentor, and maybe you could talk about ways to go about finding a sponsor, particularly in more male-dominated fields and firms. Thank you.
So the best way, it's not necessarily a matter of finding a sponsor, it's a matter of asking someone to be your sponsor. Again, you have to be aggressive and very forthcoming. And once you come up with some idea of where you want your career to go, then you should look around your organization or whatever areas you might have access to and see who would be the best person to be a sponsor for you, and then ask that person. Now, so having said that, you kind of have to think about office politics and so forth. So you probably want to start with your boss or your immediate supervisor so that you don't have any problems there, and then ask them if they are not able to do it or not willing to do it, if they're okay with you approaching someone else who might be one of their peers, it might be their boss. So that's going to be the best way to handle it.
You know, one technique that I found fairly successful is sometimes if you just go in there and say to a busy person, will you be my sponsor? You know, they'll look at you and with freaked out eyes because they just really don't have the time. So I think sometimes a gentler approach where you ask them to have lunch with you and you present some ideas that you have and ask for their advice. So all they have to do in that first meeting is to give you some stuff off the top of their head. And what I've found is that if you do that a few times, over time people begin to kind of own you a little bit, and they want to help you. And so what might be just advice the first time becomes some phone calls, and it's something that you build over time. And also, it's very helpful. Remember, I was talking about that reciprocality. If you can think of something that person would like, a lot of times, and one of the simplest things to do is sometimes you know somebody or you can get to somebody that the person that you want to be your sponsor would like to meet, and you can put people together in ways, you know, at a lunch or a dinner, and that puts you in a position of really helping them. And it's oftentimes no sweat off your back if you know the person they want to meet, either personally or you have a friend who has a personal relationship with them. So there's a lot of different ways of kind of facilitating and expanding relationship with the person that you're trying to get into a sponsor role.
And along those lines, how many of you travel for your job? Some of you do. The best advice I ever heard is when you go to another city, never dine alone. So to Mary's point, pull out people from your organization that are in the city and connect people together from your different walks of your life and join them together. They will remember that you were the one that put them together when a connection happens. So it was probably the best advice I ever got.
Could you explain the difference between a mentor and a sponsor?
So a sponsor is someone who is actually in your company, more than likely, who can help you advance in the company, maybe get onto projects that you want to work on, whereas a mentor could be anybody, anywhere. They're not limited to your company, and they can help you in all different ways. It's, again, someone you can talk to, run ideas past, ask for advice, someone that you trust and someone who knows you enough to really give you frank and honest advice and feedback. Whereas usually in the sponsorship, and they are not necessarily in a position to be able to promote you or help you along in the company when they're a mentor. But a sponsor is actually someone who's in a position to actually help advance your career, right, recommend you for promotions and things like that.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take another question from the floor.
Yeah, I want to know from all of you. I initially I was going to do Mary and then Evelyn, but then I decided not to discriminate and and ask you, do you have different mentoring skills that you bring to the table for gender-related, either men and women, and also for women, particularly women of color? So do you differentiate those skills when you bring them to the table for those people?
I do mentor people based on all of their needs and all of their uniqueness. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the things that I may talk to a man about will be different. It's not going to be the same. I deal with folks very much on a one-on-one basis. And again, based on where they want to go with their career, what their plan is, what their goals and desires are, as well as my own observations about where I can help them if they're willing to listen. So it is very different. And yes, there may be different things that I would say to a woman or a man of color that wouldn't necessarily apply to a person who's not of color. But again, because we're dealing with individuals. It's not a, there's no cookie cutter yeah. mentoring approach when you're dealing with individuals, and every person's needs are different. And 9 times out of 10, their plans are very different. Their goals, their career aspirations are very different. So you work with them based on those things. So it will be very unique and individualized.
I call it, yeah, it's customized.
It's customized.
Because I also
thank
do
you.
Both men and women yeah. Mentor. And it just really depends on the questions they ask. Some women, I have 3 boys, so some of the women are really, it's really around how do I have a family and a husband and a relationship and work and my career. Very different than sometimes the men who yeah. don't have those issues. And it's mm-hmm. much, theirs are much more political.
That's right.
Around, so how do I get here and how do I do this and who's the right person to ask to make yeah. sure that I can get what I want.
That's right.
Very, very different. So I, like Mary, customize it to the individual and what they're seeking.
Okay, we're going to take another question from the floor, and it's one of our men in the audience tonight.
Yay!
A few men. Yes, I found this very interesting and enlightening. And I've noticed that you're approaching it often from a sort of a personal experience perspective and talking about your mentoring or your experiences mentoring. I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on an organization wanting to set up a mentoring program mm-hmm. to gain some of these benefits that you've been talking about, mm-hmm. the kinds of things that the elements that should be involved in it, or right. perhaps mm-hmm. strategies for making it successful.
Mm-hmm. You know, Harvard just came out with a study looking at what had been the most effective techniques over the last couple of years in major companies in getting women promoted into the pipeline. It turned out that mentoring was the most effective technique. And so there's been a lot of experimentation by American companies in this area. And a couple things that are really critical for a mentoring program to work well in an organization. One is there's got to be commitment from the top of the organization that this is a high priority, because otherwise it's very easy for a mentoring program, especially for women, to become stigmatized as sort of a, you know, the women need help and they're off on their side kind of helping themselves. I do believe that in there's no question that we have a glass ceiling that is very persistent at the tops of organizations. So the status quo is not going to get us there. There has to be some additional investment in women. But in many companies it has been marginalized because the top of the organization hasn't been completely pushing it. I think one of the critical things in mentoring is to teach the mentees how to be good mentees and what skills they need to go and put together a strong network. And so the part of teaching a mentee to be good is the skill of coming up with a plan, a communication vehicle, learning how to expand the network. So it's way beyond just linking somebody up with a higher level executive in the organization. And there's quite a bit of research that's been done on it now. I think we can do it in a very sophisticated way. And there are companies all across the U.S. that are doing it effectively. And I think what's going to happen in the next 5 years is that companies who really do well with women are going to start opening water on companies that don't in terms of the retention and recruitment. And there's also some research in the last 3 years that shows that those companies that manage to get more women up into the executive suites and the boards of directors are outperforming companies that don't on the bottom line financial results. And also that the companies that have more women are more effectively marketing to the new consumer in the marketplace, which tends to be women. So there's a lot of gearing that's working right now that I think is going to push it in the next couple of years. But mentoring will be absolutely a key part.
And there is one company called Mentium that does, it's an outside company that helps women. They usually bring in somebody from outside the firm to help mentor the women because they find sometimes inside the firm you can get caught up in the politics. So it's really outside the firm that they come in and do this. Mm-hmm. And they'll set up programs for you inside your company. Yeah. But as Mary said, she's right. It's really the mentees that need to learn how to become mentored.
That's right. But they do need help. And yeah. Companies where they have done it, the thing to remember is that there's only going to be so many per year, right? When they do have it, companies where I've worked, you're talking 10 or 12 people who get to go into that program per year, and that's men and women. So that's the challenge for corporations. A lot of them are doing it, but you just don't hear a lot about it because there's so few people that are able to go through it. And again, that gets back to why you need to have other ways of getting what you need.
But the one other thing I would say, the most stunning thing that ever happened to me at Pillsbury was when I became the CEO and all the young men lined up outside of my door to be mentored. I mean, I had never seen that behavior, mainly because I hadn't been in the job, and certainly it had never occurred to me to line up in front of the CEO's door to be mentored. And there's now, McKinsey came out with a study that showed that in general, men are, in our society, are enculturated to understand more about networks and expanding their networks and building up these mentee relationships. So I think there's no question right now women need a little extra help, on average, in learning how to do this well. So it's important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have another question from the floor.
I'm just wondering from each of you, like you might have top performers, but what would be some of those fatal flaws, either the men or the women, that stand out?
Mm-hmm. So the fatal flaws that we talk about in the book, there are several, but for women, it's being too male or female is one that came up in the course of interviewing folks for the book. And basically, I alluded a little bit to women being a little too female and how you show up. But sometimes women are too male. They are trying to create that persona and build the confidence by being too male in their appearance. And again, this was something that Eunice Azani, not just their appearance, but even their conversation and how they present themselves. And Eunice Azani said this was something that she would have to have conversations with women about, is that you will never fit into the good old boys club. And you really shouldn't try, but understand and recognize that you do fit into the big picture. And just focus on that. And so don't focus so much on trying to be too male or too female. Women tend to be too wordy. Men, for the most part, will get something said in 5 minutes, whereas women might take 15. And again, this is feedback that I got from a lot of the women that they noticed other women are taking way too many words to get their point across, whereas men get right to the point and almost leave you, you know, wanting to pull more from them as opposed to trying to give every little detail. We're very detail-oriented, and we like to go into all that detail, but it actually hurts you. It doesn't help you when you're very wordy and you tend to go on and on. Fear, which Mary alluded to and we've talked about today, but fear is a huge derailer. If you're afraid and people can sense that you're afraid, then they are not going to have confidence in you, and that's going to derail you. Catherine Arnold, who's featured in the book, who is with Credit Suisse, talks about in the investment banking arena how her advice when she first came was never let them smell blood. And so and she was terrified, but she understood that I could never let them see fear or I will lose credibility and I might as well go get another job. Not honoring the point, unfortunately, there is a lot of research to show that women don't always honor other women in leadership. And so the whole idea of when I talk about not honoring the point, this refers to hunting dogs and pointers. When they're out hunting, all the dogs are out there, and when one of them finds the prey, he points, he'll stop and point, and then all the other dogs, no matter where they are, they point at that. They honor the point of that dog who is the leader. And so that was a way to kind of express it. Unfortunately, I don't want to stereotype, but the bottom line is when there have been problems, especially in my career, with people not honoring my point, it was usually women who did not respect me as a female, but the things that they treated the male leaders very differently than how I was treated. So honoring the point, staying in your lane, if you know that your skill set is X and you really want to do Z because you're competing with whomever, that's going to be very dangerous. So know what your strong set is, your skill set is, and then once you realize that, stay in your lane. Pleasing people, obviously we talked about that. You can't please everybody. Burning bridges, being a whiner. So when you don't get what you want, that victim mentality, those are things that really derail you, and nobody wants to hear it. As a matter of fact, every job I started, I would say to my team, imagine there is a sign on my wall that says, just suck it up. I don't want to hear whining. Not listening and or adjusting to feedback. So when people do give you feedback, you need to listen to it. You need to make the adjustments. And then responding inappropriately to opposition. I think you've heard some really good advice here today when you don't get the support that you're looking for or that you feel you deserve. How you respond to that is going to be very important, and that can be a derailer if you don't handle that the right way.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program tonight where we have time for only one more question, and I'm going to take a question from another man in the audience tonight.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisella. I would like to throw in a third word, counseling, as opposed to mentoring and sponsoring. Last week, I asked Jackie Spear about a project that I've been interested in for 30 years that would have replaced the Selective Service Program with a National Youth Service Program. This is back in 1979. And it would have had women register with males at 17 and have them discuss and talk about what is civic engagement and then consider volunteering to do some kind of community service or military service. And to me, there was a recent book about Israel and how their method has impacted their entrepreneur businesses in the last 15 years. And you talk about planning and strategy, your career, this could impact youth when they're in 6th, 7th grade if they knew this was in their future and they could plan and strategies. But my frustration is that for 30 years I've gone to women caucus meetings at Democratic Party meetings and our near universal rejection of the idea. Apathy and indifference is what I experience. And I just find that very strange because, you know, it's a simple thing. I thought it was a no-brainer because I was interested in national security concerns, that this would be a way to really empower them and level the playing field, but there's no interest in even advocating or talking about such an idea.
So, okay, I'm not sure what the question is here. But
I did get it. I think that the fact that in the U.S. it's voluntary, and so women who choose to advance their careers and build their skill set through the military certainly can do that on a voluntary basis. I don't know that, you know, the selective service route and the way they do it in Israel. I think it's that's such a small country and they have so many issues, it's a little bit different why they have it mandatory for women there. But I may not be the right person because...
You know, one thing that does strike me, just going around the country and actually internationally also, talking to women about their careers... Even in every country today, women still carry more of the load at home, there's the question of when they're going to have their children. I think it's better to leave our system as flexible as it is and let women have choices, because there's so many boxes that women are still in that make it more difficult for women. So I think adding a mandatory service on top of all the other things women have got to get in place could be problematic. So I actually prefer the flexibility. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program this evening has been Achieving Success with the Help of a Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priority, with Mary Stutz, Evelyn Dilsaver, and Mary Cranston. Ladies, I'd like to ask you each to maybe give a closing comment or two, starting with Mary Cranston and working our way over.
Well, I think I think talking about these things is really important, and there is... We are at a breakthrough time in terms of the amount of research and looking into this, because the glass ceiling has been really stuck for about 10 years. There are about 14% women in the top jobs in America, whereas in the Fortune 100, there are 50% of the executive positions are held by women. They're just not getting to the top. So we've got to look at stereotyping. We've got to look at programs that are going to assist women become all they can be. And frankly, the country needs this. If you look at the demographics, there are not enough people to replace the retiring baby boomers in American corporations. It's going to be an interesting war for talent that cannot be won without women. So I think it's a time of opportunity. And if women can gain the extra skills that are necessary for dealing in a gender-biased environment, I think we're going to make a lot of progress in the next 5 to 10 years.
And I would have to say, having mentors gives you choices. I would echo Mary that we would love to see all of you in the C-suite, so then you can join us on the boards, because there's so few women on boards that I think it's really important. That's where the strategies are developed, and that's where we as women have a different point of view on a lot of things that need to be brought to the business table. And we would love to all see you there.
And my closing thoughts are just basically, it all boils down to the three things in the title of the book. It's power, progress, and priorities. So in order to build the power that you need, you've heard us talk about the confidence, having a plan, and having connections. Progress, viewing change as a positive experience, not losing ground, understanding the need for your spirit so that you continue to make progress. And then priorities. And what I like to say is, we live our life in stages and we have to make choices. So what I say to a lot of women, you can have it all, just not at the same time. So we need to understand that. And that, if you can prioritize, then that will enable the other two, power and progress. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to thank our panel tonight, Mary Cranston, Evelyn Dilsaver, and Mary Stutz. Our program has been Achieving Success with the Help of a Mentor, Women Advising Women on Power, Progress, and Priorities. I'm Kevin O'Malley, the chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. I want to thank our audience here tonight at the club, as well as our audience listening at home tonight. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.